That was so sweet. I've wanted to kill him for 50 years. And you did it. You killed him. He'll survive, I said. I just changed the rules. Opening communication. Paul was not happy with me, no doubt. I got that idea when I didn't see him again for about a month after I left him standing outside the tavern. After my showdown with Eddie, my wife and I did some sightseeing for about a week and then headed to Providence to catch our flight back home. If Paul was aboard, he didn't show himself, probably giving me the silent treatment. Just when I thought that he had dropped out of my life, perhaps forever, at least on a visual level, he reappeared about a month later, on a dazzling August day, as I was taking a jog through a magnificent public park in North Glen, Colorado, just outside of Denver. I presume he had been on the flight with me as well, but I hadn't seen him. The meandering pedestrian path circled the man-made lake and probably was a good half mile around. Paul fell in beside me after coming up from behind. I had just completed a leg of jogging and had settled back to a brisk walk. He was dressed for the part: t-shirt, shorts, athletic socks, and running shoes. "What you did was immature, foolhardy, risky, and most likely illegal," he said abruptly, as though no time had passed between then and our last conversation. "Good morning to you, too," I said cheerfully with a huge smile as perspiration ran off my brow. The weather was energizing, the setting spectacular, the park uncrowded, and my spirits were high. How could anyone be in a bad mood on such a glorious day? I was in town for 4 or 5 days to attend a conference at which I would be speaking. "You can't count on me to come to your rescue every time you get into trouble," he said, "and that's especially true if you deliberately put yourself in peril under the false assumption that no harm can come to you just because I happen to be watching over you. People have guardian angels, but people also get hurt, they get sick, they get killed. You should know that I could not have protected you or come to your rescue in that fight." It was absolutely unnecessary and represented a huge error in judgment. Wow. If he were just another guy, the words would have indicated without a doubt that the speaker was upset, angry, and frustrated. But the words carried no emotion. They were just information with no more passion than the data spit out by a calculator. He was simply supplying me with facts and offering some reasonable observations based upon those data. "You should also know that I'm disappointed in you." Okay, that last comment hurt. It was a piercing stab wound, no, a sharp, painful cut from a tomahawk. Suddenly, my high spirits began to descend. "I was just bluffing," I told him as I sucked in the fresh Rocky Mountain air. "I never would have hit him with the hatchet, and I could certainly have outrun him if he decided to call my bluff. Nevertheless, I don't want you taking me for granted. I suspect that you really believed there was no risk, that if you had found that you miscalculated, you would have been able to rely upon me to step in and protect you from harm. You can't do that, that's courting disaster. People have lost their lives thinking they were immune from harm after learning of their guardian angels. They made the mistake of thinking that angels are omniscient and infallible. They aren't. There also are rules and standards of behavior that we abide by. I tell you very sincerely that I'm very, very sorry," I said. "I don't want you to be disappointed in me." It was too nice of a day to argue, and I really was sorry. Besides, I wanted to talk about something that I considered more important: my efforts to establish some kind of telepathic link with somebody. Anybody. I had mostly been concentrating on Marco because he was an established telepath, or so Paul told me. I hadn't been making any progress that I could detect. I also occasionally tried to contact, telepathically, several of the well-known psychics who had established national reputations and who appeared regularly on television, even though I didn't hold them in very high regard. In addition, I tried directing my thoughts to friends and acquaintances, but to no avail, since I never received any telepathic replies. Of course, I'm just assuming that the lack of obvious confirmation meant that those to whom I directed my thoughts never received them. I suppose it's possible that some messages might have gotten through, but that I was never informed of such, I think it's extremely doubtful. My usual pattern was to put aside an hour or so 4 or 5 days a week, use the relaxation techniques that Paul had taught me, settle into a comfortable position in a quiet corner of the house, and practice, practice, practice. If I ever became proficient at it, I thought, it was reasonable to assume that I would be able to carry on a telepathic conversation under everyday conditions and wouldn't have to cloister myself. But that would come later, I thought. There was also a good chance that such a day would never come because I just didn't seem to be making any progress. It was easy to get discouraged with no feedback. I suppose you know that I've been following your advice, I told Paul, and have been practicing. I've really been trying to hone any latent psychic skills I may have. Quite frankly, I don't think I have any. I'm getting nowhere. Paul was aware of my efforts and simply suggested that I keep trying. I asked him if there was anything he could do to help speed up the process, perhaps even spend time tutoring me, actually showing me what I should be doing, what I should be saying, how I could direct my thoughts toward a particular individual or how to go about actually receiving someone else's thoughts. The initial excitement of the prospect of developing such ability had worn off and the effort to develop it had become a drudge. If I could get some confirmation that the process was working, I could approach the project with renewed enthusiasm and vigor, I told him. Stop trying to read minds, he said. I didn't understand. You are not fully opening yourself to allow the thoughts to flow freely, especially thoughts coming inward. Instead of trying to make yourself receptive to what messages others may be sending you, you're trying to read minds. You aren't a mind reader and you never will be. Well, I could agree with that, but I don't think I ever entertained the notion that I was. Your approach is a bit anal, you know, Paul added. Don't try to push it. Just relax, open up, and be receptive. The same thing applies, although to a lesser degree, when you are trying to contact others. Transmitting, if I may describe it like that, does require a bit more of an active approach than receiving. Transmitting and receiving. I wondered if that made me some kind of two-way radio a walkie-talkie. As for holding your hand and taking you step by step through the process tutoring you, that is not the way things work. Practice is the best instructor, he said. Have you ever heard that maxim? Before I could respond, he continued, you have to find the will and the resolve within if you want to reap the rewards. That is the only way you will become accomplished. It is a gift that, paradoxically, no one else can give to you. You must give it to yourself or you will never receive it. Maybe I'm not cut out for it, I said. As far as I can tell, I have made no progress at all, and I have been working at it. We had circled the pond, or lake, whatever it was. I had caught my breath and was about to start jogging again, but instead stopped walking when a middle-aged woman who had approached us from the opposite direction spoke to me. She was about 10 feet away when she called my name. She was dressed in a white halter top, white shorts, white socks trimmed in pink, and white athletic shoes. I don't know anything about such things, but I would guess that her hair was cut in a sort of pageboy style. That is, it was rather short, coming down to about the neck and curled under. It was light brown with liberal strands of grey throughout, but also had streaks of a silver blonde that most likely were artificially added for style. The effect was not unattractive. She was on the tall side for a woman, almost my height, and it was obvious that she took some pride in her appearance. She was slender and athletic looking with no middle-age roll of flab showing on her bare midriff. In other words, the type of mature woman who probably would be the envy of friends and acquaintances, especially those fighting the eternal battle of the bulge, and those who wished they had the same kind of metabolism to retain their girlish figures. The woman had brown eyes, a rather angular nose, lips neither thin nor full. I didn't notice any obvious makeup, and tiny beads of sweat made her face glisten slightly. She was neither beautiful nor plain. I guessed her age as somewhere between late 40s and mid 50s, a pretty wide range. But I'm not very good at such guessing games. I stopped when she spoke to me, as did Paul. She introduced herself as Sheila and said she had traveled more than 50 miles for the sole purpose of attending my lecture at the nearby hotel where the Golden Wings conference was being held. Do you mind if I walk with you? She asked. No, That's fine, I said. Actually, I was just about to do another lap jogging, but I'll walk with you if you prefer. She agreed to jog with me. As it turned out, she and I had similar workout routines in that we would jog until we became winded, walk until we regained our breath, jog some more, and repeat the cycle for an hour or so. Paul accompanied us, although he certainly wasn't doing the same work the woman and I were doing. Paul never worked up a sweat when matching me during workouts, no matter how strenuously I exerted myself. In fact, he never seemed to exert himself. Nor did I ever see him sweat, come to think of it. After we had jogged halfway round the course, Sheila hadn't given any indication that she had taken notice of Paul. That likely meant that he did not exist as far as she was concerned. Nevertheless, rather than risk embarrassing myself by either mentioning him or by speaking to him, I decided to try to work the subject into the conversation. "Is this your first time at this park?" I asked. "You said you live quite far from here." "Oh, no, I've been here before. I come up this way on occasion. It's a beautiful setting, isn't it?" There it was, my opening. "Gorgeous," I said. "We discovered it yesterday when we were out for a walk. So we jogged for an hour and then came back again this morning. We finished the lap silently and then fell into a walk again. We both took a minute to slow down the huffing and puffing." "Who?" Sheila finally asked. "Who what?" "You said you were with someone. Is your wife with you?"
"Ah.
No, it's a friend," I said. "An old buddy. A very old buddy, you might say." I gave Paul a look, but he didn't acknowledge it. "Did he leave?" she asked, looking around. He winked at me and then just vanished. He didn't even fade to an apparition. He just disappeared. "Oh, he's around someplace," I said nonchalantly. "He may have gone back to the hotel." It was the truth. I couldn't swear that he hadn't gone back. It certainly was possible, although I doubted it. We walked and jogged a couple more laps while engaging in small talk until we mutually agreed that we should be getting back. As we headed for the hotel, which was within sight, and where she also had booked a room, Sheila asked me if I could do her a big favor. She had a manuscript that she wanted me to read and proffer an opinion. I almost groaned aloud. She was one of those, I thought. How I hated being put on the spot like that. Most authors who have been published eventually will be approached at least once and most likely numerous times by aspiring writers who want a free assessment of their literary works. I don't like to hurt their feelings. But I learned the hard way that it is best to say no at the very beginning. Not maybe. Not perhaps, not if I can find some time. It must be a clear and unequivocal number. I'm no expert and I'm not qualified to assess the creative work of others. That was not the business I was in when I had a newspaper career. The two fields are distinct and separate, although there are some similarities. I told Sheila quite bluntly that there was no time in my schedule for such a chore. I hated to do it. But this is one time when there is no substitute for brutal honesty. She seemed like a nice person and I liked her. Besides, she was visually appealing, sexy, if you will, and I enjoyed her company. But I vowed after the first time I was maneuvered and pressured into reading someone's manuscript that I would never allow that to happen again. In that incident, when I gave my honest opinion of the piece as requested by the author, a friend of an acquaintance, she slapped my face so hard that I thought for a moment she might have dislocated my jaw. And then she began bawling, a terrible, shrill wailing that was as painful to the ears and nerves as the sound of fingernails being drawn across a blackboard. I was caught completely off guard by her reaction. Fortunately, we were out on my patio at the time and not in some public place like a library. Thank goodness for small favors. Luckily, hardly anyone is home in my neighborhood during weekdays because most people work, so I wasn't too concerned about the outburst drawing undue attention. I was more concerned about the woman's well-being. I prayed, figuratively speaking, that she wouldn't faint or bust a blood vessel. I was speechless. I instinctively reached out and laid a hand upon her shoulder to try to console her, but mostly to shut her up. Mercy, that wailing was unnerving me. She immediately batted away my hand and, again to my utter disbelief, She caught me with another roundhouse that landed partially on my left ear. That really hurt, and my ear immediately began to ring so loudly that I thought surely it would be audible to bystanders if there had been any. Now I was annoyed. I then figured that she must be a mental case, so I didn't say or do anything except step back and cringe in discomfort. Still sobbing, she snatched the bound manuscript from the patio table and stormed out of my yard, weeping all the way to her car parked in my driveway. As she drove away, my ringing ear thanked me that at least it was no longer being subjected to the woman's shrieks. That was some relief, although it still hurt like the devil for close to an hour afterward. Needless to say, she hasn't spoken to me since, and the acquaintance who introduced us also has become distant and cold. That was the first and last time I ever allowed myself to be talked into critiquing someone's manuscript. A person could go deaf. Thankfully, Sheila was understanding and took the rejection gracefully. We arrived at the hotel and went to our respective rooms. I took a short nap before getting cleaned up and dressed in less casual attire. I was about to leave my room to wander around the conference when the phone rang. Sheila asked me if I wanted to join her for a bite to eat. It seemed like a harmless enough request, so I met her at a restaurant. "How hungry are you?" she asked before we entered. "Not very," I said. "But I'll sit with you while you have something. It's still a little early." "I'm not really hungry yet, either. How about if we go to the bar and have a drink first? I could go for a vodka tonic." "Sure, if you don't mind if I just have a diet cola," I said. "Oh, that's no fun," she said, extending her lower lip in a flirtatious, exaggerated pout. "Come on, loosen up. You'll have a drink with me, won't you? Pretty please, pretty please, pretty please." Well, she was playful, interesting, and cute. "Okay, I'll have one drink," I told her. "Oh, goody," she said, clapping her hands together in a little girl gesture of glee. We settled at a table facing each other, and Paul stood behind her. No one noticed him, and I pretended not to. I ordered a vodka and tonic for each of us. Sheila told me about her divorce and her two grown children, then asked me about my family. She finished her drink and ordered another. I was still nursing mine. She asked me about my books, travels, media interviews. She finished her second drink at the same time that I finished my first. "Let's have another," she said. "You go ahead," I told her. "I think I'll pass. We can talk. This is wonderful. I really wanted to hear your lecture, but I didn't know that I'd be spending the evening with you when I made my plans to come here." She ordered another round. "Oh, well, it couldn't hurt," I figured. I saw one of Paul's eyebrows lift when the fresh drinks were delivered. Sometimes he can be a pain in the rear, I thought, and immediately felt guilty about thinking it. The drink had relaxed me and I was feeling mellow. "Oh, why not?" I thought, so I started in on the second one. Sheila started looking more attractive and our patter seemed to be getting wittier. She finished her third drink and ordered a fourth, which lasted just long enough for me to finish my second. Now I was feeling little pain and was enjoying our meaningless banter immensely. In fact, I began thinking she was quite the conversationalist, and to faith that sudden recognition I ordered another round, my third drink and her fifth. She polished that one off in no time but, lady that she was, waited patiently as the level of my drink gradually shrank while we chatted. When I finally got to the bottom of the glass, she quickly looked around for our server. It suddenly occurred to me I truly was too uptight and rigid in my day-to-day living, that I should resolve to let my hair down more often, to have more fun. With that in mind, I didn't object when she ordered another round, but I made a mental note that it would be my last. Sheila was on her sixth and I was on my fourth. I was tipsy. Our hands were resting on the table only inches apart when she very deliberately and naturally intertwined the fingers of her right hand with my left. This wasn't good, I thought. She was looking more physically appealing by the minute or by the drink, actually, and her idle chatter began skipping along the edge of profundity. It was brilliant, deeply intense, insightful. At this point, the part of my brain that controls higher functions such as sound judgment had already crawled off into some corner to take a nap. That left me at the mercy of what was still awake, and we know what's usually going on in there. I certainly was conscious of a robust physical attraction that I was feeling. It was becoming obvious where this evening was going to end if I allowed it to happen. I don't know why, but I turned my attention to Paul. His face was pretty much emotionless, but he very imperceptibly shook his head and mouthed the word no several times. Maybe he actually said it, but if he did, I didn't hear it. Talk about being conflicted. I tried to gently withdraw my hand, but she kept a firm grip. "I'm married, you know," I said. My speech was slurred. "So was I. So what? It doesn't bother me. And you don't have to worry, I can keep a secret," she said seductively. Sheila was slurring her words. I had to admire her in a dubious, almost perverse, sort of way, though, because she already had 5 drinks under her belt, was working on the 6th, and she was still more or less able to keep herself from sliding under the table. With her smaller body, she had less blood than I have, which means that her blood alcohol level would have to have been considerably higher than mine even if I matched her drink for drink. I had now finished only 3 drinks and felt that I would be on my face under the table if I finished the one in front of me. Was this a regular routine with her? If it was, I wondered how she could continue to keep her girlish figure. Maybe the running was designed specifically to burn off those alcoholic calories. Paul apparently had given up on me. He was gone. I knew that I was treading on shaky ground, but the vodka had set up shop in my brain and by now was pretty much calling the shots, in a manner of speaking. It had tucked my more rational thought processes into bed, kissed them nifty night, and had thrown open the door to some late arrivals to the party who had come to liven things up. I know them by the names basic instincts, urges, desires, you can call them what you will. And then it hit me so suddenly that it almost knocked me out of my seat. The words were so clear and distinct that my first thought was that someone had actually come up behind me and spoken directly into my ears. "Be careful. Leave. Excuse yourself." I visibly winced and snapped my head around to see who had spoken. Sheila and I were still alone. I was overwhelmed by a sheer sense of terror, and yet there was nothing toward which I could point as the source. I felt the blood drain from my head. The fear turned cold as my brow and hands became clammy. My heart began pounding, my vision narrowed as though I were falling backward into a tunnel. I imagined that this must be how our primitive ancestors felt when they came face to face with danger in which they had to decide either to fight or flee. It was as though some organ or organs in my body had abruptly dumped a barrel of chemicals into my bloodstream. But there was nothing to fight, so my instinct was to flee, to run out of the room in blind, mindless terror. But why? What was there to flee from? I would look like a fool. I couldn't fight and I couldn't flee, so I simply froze. I was absolutely convinced without a doubt that I was dying. There could be no other explanation. So this was what it was like to have a heart attack or a stroke, whatever it was that had stricken me, and my life was going to end on a barroom floor 1,000 miles from home, I thought. "Are you okay?" Sheila asked, a look of alarm spreading across her features. I wasn't, and I was probably as pale as an overcast day. I tried to control my breathing, which had become labored and shallow. I wasn't on the verge of panic. I had already gone well over that line. A steel band had clamped itself around my chest, constricting my breathing, and I was certain that my lungs weren't getting enough oxygen to deliver to my pixelated brain. Just at the moment when I was totally convinced that I was about to slip into a dark abyss of emptiness, that nothing could stop me now from going over the edge, the terror began to wane. I had peaked. Ice cubes skittered across the slick surface of the table, and the remnants of Sheila's vodka and tonic pooled briefly before beginning to flow in ever so slow rivulets outward. She had knocked over her glass with an elbow while still clinging tightly to my hand. She stared helplessly, a look of distress in her eyes as I struggled for control. We both sat quietly for several minutes while I consciously and silently talked myself down from the episode. Gradually, the feeling of dread passed and I finally regained control. I nodded to her. She took the hand she was holding into both of hers. "My God, you looked like you were going to jump out of your skin," she said, patting my moist hand. I couldn't tell her, but I suspected that it was the disembodied voice that I had heard with such clarity that started my panic event. After I had regained my composure and convinced myself that I was not at death's door, I searched my thoughts for an explanation. I considered the possibility that I was going mad. How else to explain hearing a voice that isn't there? No, that would leave Paul out of the equation. And then I heard it again. "Leave. Excuse yourself. You will regret it deeply if you don't, and it will change your life drastically." But this time I didn't panic because I understood, and a soothing relaxation began settling over me, which had nothing to do with the booze. I still can't say to this day whether I actually heard the words. Certainly Sheila hadn't, or if they were thoughts so strong, so precise, so pronounced and forceful that my brain actually interpreted them as electrical signals traveling through my auditory system. But I knew where they had come from. It was Marco. He didn't have to identify himself. I knew because I knew, just as I knew that I had just been the recipient of an enormous privilege. I had received and understood a strong, clear telepathic message. "I'm sorry," I said to Sheila, "but I have to leave. Thank you for the company. I enjoyed our visit." I extracted my hand from hers, placed a $5 tip on the table. The drinks had been paid for as we ordered them and went back to my room. I prepared for bed but lay awake for about an hour trying to re-establish contact with Marco. He had kept me from walking. Stumbling is more like it, considering the vodka in my blood streamed down a perilous road, and I wanted to thank him. As far as I know, I didn't have any success. Contact. After returning home, I got into the habit of working fairly diligently and with some regularity on trying to develop any extrasensory skills I might possess. In September I thought I had made some slight progress when whole, articulated, silent thoughts seemed to cross my mind. They were rather prosaic, even banal, signifying nothing, but I knew again deep in my bones that they were tidbits from Marco. He was working with me, helping me, giving me encouragement. Practice, practice, practice had become my mantra. Meanwhile, I wasn't seeing Paul as often as I had been during our so-called therapy sessions. September rolled into October and I was growing impatient with what I perceived as the incredibly slow pace of my progress, which I had expected to increase exponentially after my first tentative success at receiving Marco's communication. I was hoping that I would be able to achieve a very high level of proficiency, at least equivalent to the degree to which I received the message in the Denver barroom. It seemed that at the pace I was going it would take forever to get to that point. The last time I had seen Paul, late in September, I had asked him if he could arrange a face-to-face meeting between Marco and me. I felt that if I could sit down and talk with him man to boy, as it were, he would be able to offer me some words of advice, some guidance on how to speed up the process. I felt intuitively that I was capable of a high degree of proficiency that was indicated in Denver. But I also needed to know if any of my thought messages were getting through to Marco. While I was receiving some messages from the boy, I wanted to know if I was also successfully conveying. Paul can be so mysterious at times, which also has the potential to drive me to distraction under the right circumstances. Or maybe I'm just too naive, unsophisticated, not smart enough to understand what should be plainly obvious. He declined my request without explanation and refused to provide me with any details when I pressed him. "Why don't you just ask him?" Paul said. "If you are receiving from him, certainly he would be able to tell you if he has gotten any thoughts from you as of yet." I just stared at him dully. I smacked my forehead with the palm of a hand. "What is the matter with me?" I thought. The answer was so blatantly obvious that I was almost embarrassed for not seeing it. "I don't pay much attention to what most people think about me, if anybody thinks about me at all, but I wanted Paul to have a bit more than lackluster regard for me. Or, at the very least, that he not think of me as a dunce." Something I was feeling like at that moment. "In fact," Paul continued, "do you really need such confirmation? After all, Marco is a telepathic savant. They don't get any better than him. Clearly he is receptive to your thoughts based upon the Bahram incident. Wouldn't you agree? It appeared that he was right again. But the circumstances were different, so perhaps it didn't necessarily follow that I was successfully sending.